Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
My guest today is Leonora Neville, who has written Heroes and Romans in 12th Century Byzantium, which I highly recommend reading, about Nikephoros Priennus, the husband, infamous husband of Anna Karenina. What is it about this era that kind of fascinated you, that made you really study this 12th Century Byzantium?
I discovered Byzantium when I was in my first year of college, and I was studying both a lot about a constructed history of Western civilization and Roman history. And I was fascinated to learn that the eastern half of the Roman Empire didn't fall when it was supposed to in order to make the narrative of Western Civ be a coherent story.
That's kind of the biggest misconception about history, isn't it? That Rome fell in 476.
Exactly. Right. So, and I had some of my teachers going with the story that Rome fell in the fourth century in the course of Western civilization was that it was cast off from its ancient roots at that point. And then I learned that that just wasn't true and that the Eastern Roman Empire remained Aristotle reading, Homer quoting classical civilization in some ways and Christian clear through the Middle Ages. And then it was actually conquered by Western European crusaders in the 13th century. So that disjuncture between the standard narrative that's so deeply embedded in our culture and what seemed to be this alternative reality was so striking that I started reading about Eastern Roman history pretty avidly when I was quite young, and I've been doing it ever since. What I love about 12th century history is that it's one of those eras in which they are engaging in very interesting ways with that classical heritage.
It's kind of an era that's unavoidable, that everyone knows about the Crusade and everyone knows about 12th century. It's kind of unavoidable, basically.
Right. Yeah. So it's something that's, there are very interesting cultural things happening in Western Europe as well. And the Crusades are perennial interest for a lot of people. So that attracted me to the topic as well, certainly. And then I started, my first book was actually on taxation and looking for the great Byzantine bureaucracy, and I couldn't find it. I'm doing social history in the provinces, and the sources were very small and difficult to work with, and I had a lot of fun writing the book. But when I was done with that one, I wanted to study a story about people doing deeds in chronological order. So I picked the history of Nikephoros Vrenios as something to study, just because I wanted a bit of a change. And it was so satisfying. It's a beautiful little history. It's not all that long. And it's a very personal account of a disastrous decade of history. So it covers the 1070s, and it was written in probably the 1120s or 1130s, so it's not entirely clear when it was composed. And it's Nikephoros Vrenios talking about a period of intense civil war in which the Eastern Roman Empire is really struggling through a lot of very difficult external problems, in that they're losing southern Italy to the advances of the Normans, and they're also losing a lot of territory in the east to the Seljuk Turks. So it's militarily a really disastrous decade. And it made a whole lot worse by the fact that they were constantly fighting each other in civil wars.
So it's the Romans loved their civil wars, didn't they?
Yeah, excuse me?
The Romans loved their civil wars, didn't they?
Well, the Romans managed to stave off civil war quite a lot of the time. That's why the empire lasted so long.
What are we going to do now? Oh, I guess we're going to have another civil war. That's fun.
Yes, more civil wars. At this point, there was Lots of different families were vying for control and power and being very destructive and distracting from the major fights they needed to have against the external enemies. And then Nikephoros never finished his history. So it breaks off just before the period in which Alexius Komnenos won the civil wars by defeating his rivals and then knitting the polity back together in a very stable way. So he rules, Alexius rules from 1081 to 1118. Yeah. And he manages to take control largely because he defeats the enemies that that are obdurate, and knits everyone together in marriage alliances. Between he and his mother worked so that by the time Nikephoros is writing, all the formal rivals are all married and they've all got grandchildren. So basically Nikephoros's history is the story of how grandpa captured and blinded your other grandpa, right? Because everybody at the court within his family unit, right? They all had relatives who were on different parts of this disastrous civil war period, but they were all had intermarried and they were their family. So when I say it's an intimate history, it's a history the audience of which is the grandchildren and the cousins and the nieces and nephews of the people who are fighting so bitterly decades in the past.
Yeah.
So, as I see it, it's got some big themes of civil war is bad, unity is good, and boy, our family is kind of messy. Let's think through that. Yeah. Right. So it sets up the people who are listening, the audience, and who I think are just the court of Constantinople, the relatives, for conversations about history, right? Yeah. How are we going to think through this? How are we going to reconcile ourselves to what's going on?
Anna Komnene is obviously way more, most people have read somewhat Byzantine, probably heard Anna Komnene, but how come she is so much more famous than her husband? And it's kind of fascinating to me because, you know, this era is a man's world and she because managed to become more famous than her husband, who wrote history as well. So how come she became more famous? Was it because she was kind of the first Western female historian? Is that what was so intriguing about her?
No, not at all. It's because her history is much longer. It's more substantive. It's much better. In variety of the topics that it covers. So the Alexiad, her history has been famous for ages because it's the Eastern account of the First Crusade. And it's the Eastern account of the rise of the Turks and a lot of very significant military events. So her reputation rests on the strength and detail of her military narrative and her interpretation of the First Crusade. Her history is much longer than her husband's and far more detailed. And she goes back and retells the stories that he tells about the rise of Alexius in the beginning of her history. She has a different take on Alexius and a different interpretation.
Because she is his daughter, she wants to put him in a good light. She praises him, whereas Nikephoros, as you men talked about in your book, he is rather critical of Alexius.
Yeah, I think in terms of understanding the Alexiad, it helps to read the two documents, the two histories together, because I think she comes, as you say, she is his daughter. She wants to make him look good. Everyone thinks that she's doing this to praise Alexius because she's sycophantic. She's also doing a direct corrective to the criticism in her husband's history, right? So she takes every point at which Nikephoros insinuates that Alexius was dishonorable, and she makes that a point that she praises him on. And if you only read the Alexiad without reading Nikephoros, she can seem odd, like why is she stressing so much that this is her dad who did this? A great example is in the story of the big final battle between Nikephoros' grandfather, who's also named Nikephoros Cranius, the elder, and Alexius. In Nikephoros' story, Alexius just kind of doesn't do much, and his Turkish mercenaries make all the choices and do all the fighting and win the battle for him. And he just sets up a bunch of tricks and winds up the victor. And then in Anna's account, she retells it. at a lot of places who says, my father did this, my father, my father, my father. And it's early on in the Alexiad. And when you read that story, what the impression modern readers get is, why is she constantly calling him my father?
Yeah.
Right. And they're missing the fact that she's inserting all of those places where Nikephoros' story, it's the Turkish mercenaries did this, the Turkish mercenaries did this. So that's one example of a change.
It's fascinating, though, that she don't choose to write about him in third person, whereas, you know, a lot of, like Julius Caesar, for example, write about himself in third person.
Yeah.
But she doesn't write Alexius, she writes my father, like you said.
Yeah, yeah. She is emphasizing that it's a relationship as well, absolutely. You know, but that's one of several places where she's correcting Nikephoros' text to make her dad look better.
Yeah.
And hold up his history. I think when you think about why did he not get more famous, everything in Nikephoros' history is also in others. So it's not what we call an independent source.
Yeah.
We have no manuscript of it at all anymore. It's only known from one transcription of a manuscript that was lost in France in the late 17th or 18th centuries, right?
Yeah.
And it seems that manuscript, the lost one, had a complete, excellent copy of the Alexiad and Nikephoros' history. The people who were working on it in the 1630s and 1640s believed that it was, in fact, Anna's autograph. Like, that was the book into which she wrote the Alexiad. And it was after her husband's history. So it seems as if that text always had a very small circulation. So we don't, which is why when I call it an intimate family history, it's a history of family for family, designed to be read in that pretty small circle. And I don't think very many people, either in the Middle Ages or now, have read it. There are a bunch of people, there are several English translations that are sort of in preparation.
Yeah.
And I think once they get published, it'll be a little bit more widely read. It's available in French, so it's not as if it's that obscure.
Unfortunately, I don't speak French, so
yeah, doesn't help everybody. But at least it's in a modern language, unlike some Byzantine texts. So those are some reasons why it's just never as famous. In terms of the writing, it's much simpler. It's classical Greek style, but it's sort of patterned on Xenophon or Plutarch. It's fairly simple, straightforward prose, whereas Anna draws on a lot of Homer and Aeschylus and ancient Greek, the tragic epic style writing. And the prose is just much more complex and formal. So the writing is really different, but also the scale is really different. Nikephoros' history is like maybe 80 to 100 pages, whereas hers is just much, much larger.
Yeah, and you touched upon this as well, that Nikephoros, and we talked about this, that he's critical against Alexius. Could this be because, you know, you say that he's in the books and he's passed away by the time he writes his later books in his history, but they also touch that he is critical because, you know, his father had led a failed rebellion against the emperor at the time. Do forgive me, I forget what his name was, because there were probably so many of them at the time. But is this why that he is critical because his father, Nikephoros the elder, led a failed rebellion?
It could be. I mean, yes, it's either his father or his grandfather is Nikephoros the Elder. I think it's his grandfather. That's a side point. He definitely knows, had Nikephoros the Elder won that fight, then Nikephoros the author would be emperor, right? And I think that would be something of a thing you have to try to work through as living your life, that it nearly was me on the throne. I think the case he makes for why Nikephoros the Elder would have been a much better emperor than Alexius is pretty strong. And the criticism of Alexius changes over the course of the Nikephoros' history is divided into four books. And in the first two, Alexius seems, is described in very overblown heroic terms So it's very hyperbolic praise. Like, he's so awesome. He's so fabulous. But he's shown actually messing up and getting people killed and falling into problems. And
we know that another bloody rebellion and the you know, his entry to the Tower into, we know how bloody that was when he entered and became emperor. Which, yeah, Anna doesn't really touch too much upon, because that would put him in a bad light, wouldn't it?
No, she says a lot about, we know that his coup was bloody and awful only because of the Alexiad. Right? That's a, people miss all the places where she is, in fact, giving us lots of negative information about Alexius. She's the one who reveals that his coup was really bloody. The coup story where Alexius takes power is not narrated in Nikephoros's history because he didn't finish it. And it's, he maybe didn't finish it because he didn't want to get into that difficult part of the story. But the bloody sack of the city is known largely in the details from the Alexiad. Yeah. He was, you know, honest about that problem. Nikephoros is paving a way to lead up for it. So the first two books, he makes Alexius look a little bit ridiculous and a little bit overblown. And then as it goes on, he also makes him seem calculated and callous, so that it, when Alexius is serving as an advisor to one of the emperors who's about to get deposed, he's saying, well, the easy way for you to stay in power is just go murder all the protesters outside, and give advice that's really quite chilling and saying, go murder people. So that's a different, there's a different feeling to that criticism of Alexius. Consistent throughout all four books is that Alexius is portrayed as winning only through deception. And there's a ton of fighting in this book. And there are patterns that you can see if you analyze like how the different modes. And all the Turks and Alexius fight deceptively, and all the Romans fight in a straightforward eye-to-eye, man-to-man style. Yeah. And when you fight straight up, eye-to-eye, man-to-man, you lose. Right. So all the honorable, good, straightforward fighting leads to defeat, and all the deceptive, dishonorable, sneaky fighting leads to victory. Right. And so that's a consistent pattern that Nikephoros sets up, which aligns Alexius with the Turks, who are, of course, enemies. Right.
So the we did talk about this actually in way back when I made with the, made the episode about Alexius Comnenus in March, how we, that it wasn't necessarily a great general.
Yeah.
He did lose a lot of battles as well.
Yeah. He lost a lot of them. Again, which we know largely from the Alexiad, right?
Yeah.
So when Anna retells these stories, she's at pains to portray as good generalship fighting with deception, right? Yeah. Whereas Nikephoros is pretty clearly saying that good, proper, honorable generalship is fighting straightforward, right? And Anna says, well, actually, victory by any means is victory, right? And she makes the case for fighting with deception as a way of countering her husband's history of Alexius. But she also lets us know all the big battles that he lost. And so her history is not really, I think, particularly biased at all. It's got rhetoric that presents herself as very loyal to her dad, which I think was essential for her to be seen as a responsible, reasonable author, as a woman. She had to be loyal to her dad. But she shows us all his dirty underwear in terms of the problems that he had in his rule. So, you know, Nikephoros' criticism, it does ratchet up over the course of his book. And it makes it difficult to know when we should put the time of his composition, right? Like, did he write it when Alexius was still alive? Did he write it after he died?
Yeah.
He left it unfinished when he died, which is probably in like 1136.
That seems to be the case about a lot of historians in that time, that they never finished their work. Like Tacitus, right. And then,
hey, a lot of historians now never finish their books.
Yeah.
You keep talking. No. There's a lot of unfinished books that lie on desks, you know. So that doesn't really tell us anything that he didn't finish it when he died. It's possible that he started writing it when Alexius was still alive, and then it got the more critical parts came after he died. I think that his brother-in-law, Ioannis, who succeeded Alexius, might have been perfectly happy to have someone be critical of his dad, right? You're taking it up the job after 40 years of somebody else, and you're trying to create your own space and your own.
No age. Pressure at all there.
Yeah, exactly. I think he'd be, there's no reason that we think that John would be mad that Nicky Forrest is criticizing his dead father, right? Mm. And I don't see any particular reason to think that Nicky Forrest and Ioannis...
It didn't seem to be that... And we talked about this in the Anatom Nerne episode as well that we did a while back. About he didn't seem to be that fan of his father, since he's just, according to the Alexian anyhow, that he just rushes basically to get to the throne.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem like to be that great father-son relationship. Like, that's why I feel like he can criticize Alexius kind of.
Exactly, yeah. Also, we know from the Alexiad that in Alexius's last years, he would give general jobs, jobs to lead the army when he could no longer do it, to people other than John, right? Ioannis. Yeah. He didn't give it to him. Mm-hmm. Didn't trust either him or Nikephoros with an army. It's not as if Alexius did much to put Ioannis in power or give him power and control. So I could see there's reason for tension and worry there.
What he also discussed is that, of course, Nikephoros tried to have a coup d'etat according to some historians. I think there's been a debate whether it happened or not, but he did try. But how did he feel about his so-called failed coup d'etat, if it happened or if it didn't happen? It seemed to be like a little debate there, whether it happened or not.
I think it happened. I don't think there was anything. He sets up, Nikephoros in his history makes a case that he himself probably would have been a really good emperor, because he makes the case that his grandfather would have been a great emperor. Mm. And he makes the case that Alexius wasn't really good. Mm. He also makes that case, don't forget, that civil war is awful. Right. Yeah. So he's making a strong case that you need to have unity and just deal with an emperor, whether you like him or not, so that you don't fight. So I see that as both an apology for why he maybe didn't go through with trying to take power, and why he supported Ioannis, even though he thought that he would make a better emperor himself.
Yeah.
I think that there's Zonaras, some other historians say that Nikephoros was given authority by Alexius's wife when Alexius was really sick.
Yeah.
Gave some power. Yeah. So he might have had some power then, which would make a lot of sense if Alexius was worried about his son, right? Yeah. So if Alexius worried about his son taking over too soon, right, and is pushing Ioannis away, like, yeah, you're my heir, but stay away from me till I'm actually dead. You know, don't come too close. It would make sense that they would give Nikephoros some power. Yeah. And then it's a much later story that says that it was Anna who was the driving force trying to get Nikephoros to murder his brother-in-law. And I see that as just a much later misogynist slander against a woman who wrote a history. That's a much later 12th century story. So I'm on the part of the debate that says this coup never happened. Mm. What happened, there was family tension. They might have had some power.
Somebody wanted to put him in a bad light, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you mentioned that Anna is so much more famous than Nikephoros.
Yeah.
It was also, that was a very transgressive move in her culture for her to write a history. It was very self-aggrandizing. Ooh. It was very unfeminine and bucking ideas that people had for how women ought to behave. You know, women are not supposed to talk at all. You're supposed to never hear them.
They were just reproduced, basically. That's what they were for.
Yeah, yeah. You need to, their honor remained in not being heard, right? Mm. So there were certainly a lot of people who did not think it was great for her to write a history. Mm. And so I think it's that strand of this culture that led to, along with a lot of rhetorical reasons in the later history, it's Koniati's history, which is written at the end of the 12th century, and in the light of his politics, or he's trying to exonerate himself from his role in the decline of the empire and do a lot of other things, that he creates this story of blaming the rot and the decline of the empire on the house of Komnenos, on Alexius and his family, by inverting everybody's gender, having all the men act like women and all the women act like men. And that's the context for his story in which Anna is trying to murder her brother and get her husband to do it. And so that's the portrait of Vryennios, who in Koniatis is just a completely flaccid, wimpy man who doesn't have the strength to commit murder. That's a story of the coup. And I just don't see it as making any sense with these characters, given what we know from their own histories.
And I think that, you know, especially in the early 17th to early mid 20th century, that, you know, because I read the Sweeter's translation of Alexius a while ago, and they both Gibbon and Sweeter kind of tried to put Anna like she is resentful that her husband didn't go through the coup, that she has a grudge against her husband, that she thought him weak because of it, that she's a woman, that she's that they kind of try and put her like being.
So what's up with that? That is a really take that she's resentful and angry. The sense that she's resentful,
I think that Gibbon and the Sweeter kind of helped push that persona.
They definitely do. They see that her is angry. At the beginning, at the end of the Alexiad, she cries a lot for her dad, right? And her family. She's weeping and wailing. And this is a stance at which she's portraying herself as a woman in mourning. And I think it's part of the ways that she's rhetorically creating space for herself as a woman to write a history. Because Greek women can talk at funerals, right? So by framing it in a funeral lamentation creates a space for a woman's voice to be heard. It's also deeply humbling. When you see the old widow cry, you're supposed to say, oh, there, there, dear, poor you, I feel so sorry for you. And because you're feeling sorry for her, you're not going to be angry that she's being so arrogant to tell you what you ought to think about history, right? But that, so there's a lot of very clear reasons within her culture for why she would portray herself as mourning. But when you get to Edward Gibbon, he doesn't know anything about Byzantine culture.
Yeah, he hated the Byzantines.
He totally hated Byzantine culture. He sees her weeping and wailing. And then they're saying, like, well, this is nuts. She's crying about some guy who died in his 70s, 20, 30 years ago. It's not real. She must be angry, right?
Didn't he say that the Alexiad was like everything wrong with writing history?
Oh, yeah. He said it portrays on every page the vanity of a female author.
Yeah.
He hated the Alexiad. But if you read Edward Gibbon's account of the Crusades, every point he makes is one that animated the Alexiad.
Yeah.
So they agree.
Hypocritical.
Yeah, exactly. He uses all of her ideas and her perceptions of the West, are the ones that he uses in his interpretation.
Yeah.
So he's all over the Alexiad, but he has to denigrate it because it's got this female author thing. So it's because she seems sad, and so she can't be sad. She must be angry. What's she angry about? Oh, she must be angry about the fact that she didn't get power because she must have been masculine because she wrote a history.
Yeah. Right?
And so there's some 19th century historians who are saying, well, because she wrote a history, it's obvious that she was masculine and wanted power, because why would she be interested in politics?
Yeah. Right?
You know, therefore,
I mean, she's a woman. She has nothing to do with politics. Yeah. Woman can't do politics at all, you know?
Yes, you see it. Exactly. Right, it's exactly. She can't be interested in military history. Oh, she must have wanted to be a man. She must have wanted to be emperor. Yeah. Oh, yeah, she's crying. She's angry.
Yeah.
So that's kind of this, I find this truly tragic thing where she did so much within her rhetoric to seem modest and humble and like a good girl who was loyal and had all these positive things. And that's all been misinterpreted now, so that we think that she was arrogant and bloodthirsty and full of herself, and it all backfires.
Yeah.
It's all, so that, I mean, that's sort of getting sidetracked from Nikephoros, but her history, I think, has been really misunderstood because we don't think through how she was trying to make her gender palatable as a female historian. And then the upshot for Nikephoros of that is that he's gone and down in history essentially as a wimp, because as this, you know, unambitious, flaccid man, because he didn't murder his brother-in-law, right? And that's what I get with you, these nice
yeah.
historians who are sitting around, you know, denigrating him for not committing murder. And you have to wonder, like, really, can you think for a moment? Do you really want to say that, like, murder would have been great?
Yeah.
are you actually arguing for fratricide? And I think that Nikephoros's history needs to really speak for itself. You actually read that and see it. As this guy, he never would have killed his brother, right? He's arguing throughout this that these civil wars are awful for the Roman Empire, right?
I would discuss this in the episode of Agenda. I mentioned this one. We went with Anthony Caldelli's Ruftermain in April, last April, where he said that he was much more interested in Anna Comnena, the historian, than what she would have been like as an empress.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, we can know something about Anna Comnena as the historian, and she's interesting as an intellectual. And the story of the failed coup also means that she's mostly famous for not having been empress, right? Yeah. Right? Her fame comes from this failed political moment rather than the fact that she's one of the greatest, you know, women intellectuals of the pre-modern world.
Yeah.
So yeah, she's much more interesting as a historian.
Because you have to remember that this was a total different time than we live in right now. That this,
yeah.
It wasn't necessarily that great time to be a woman in the Orthodox world. You know, this might be the case even up to Russia in the revolution.
Yeah,
because you know they had Orthodoxy, and Orthodoxy weren't necessarily kind to women.
I tried to figure out when I was writing my book on Anna, who was the you know, I say that she's the first woman to write a history that's a proper history according to the rules of the genre in Greek. When was the second, right? And I couldn't find, I mean, my research was not extensive. I couldn't find any evidence of a woman writing a history in Greek before Second World War, right? And we get to the middle of the 20th century, when women are entering the academy, there's no evidence that women wrote history in that culture.
That's crazy. That is so strange.
And it's because the modesty is the most important virtue for a woman, to be modest and to be humble. And talking about politics, history judges men's deeds, right? Tells what men did in politics and war, and basically tells you if those are good or bad, right? And so for Nikephoros to come along and tell, here's a story of things men did in battle for you to think about, reflect on who was good, who was bad.
Yeah.
Right. He's giving judgment and he's laying the table for you to have a fight about it, a conversation about it. Right. For a woman to do that puts her above the men as in the position of judge, right? Judge and narrator, and interest in politics is just, it's external to the house.
Yeah.
What a woman was supposed to be interested in is, as you said, having babies, and weaving and doing textiles.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, even the cooking. Exactly.
Yeah. Just, you know, you're supposed to be spindle and distaff. Mm. So you're not supposed to be interested in politics, which is partially another reason why Anna emphasizes her relationship with her father. A lot of this, the father, it's my family, because she's making the case that imperial history is her family's concern. Right? She is a woman who only cares about things that happen with her family. Her family just happens to be in charge of ruling the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Right? She, you know, she brings it into the house and emphasizes her familial role as one of her justifications for why she gets to talk about politics.
Yeah, exactly.
Very transgressive stuff for her to do that.
So, Nikephoros, you write about politics in the Roman Empire as well in your Heroes and Romans in the House of Comnenus. So, what was the politic in the House of Comnenus like?
I mean, I think in the 1060s and 1070s, there were one of several different families that was trying to get control, so that then they could, you know, first let's get us in power, and then we can fight against others. Alexius's mother was very astute, and she had a whole lot of children. So it talks about successful women in the 11th and 12th century producing a lot of babies. She had a large number of children who survived to adulthood.
And we talked about this as well Yeah, and I think it's you. I don't remember where I read it, but it was like Anna wasn't the only Anna in the family. She's the most famous Anna.
Yeah.
But there was like two, three other Annas, Anna Komnenas in the family as well.
Yeah, yeah. So her grandmother, Anna, so you name the children get named after the grandparents, which is why Nikephoros, I think, is the grandson of Nikephoros, the rebel. And Anna was named after her father's mother, Anna Delasimi, who had a whole bunch of children and successfully arranged marriages with them into many of the different factions who were fighting, right?
Yeah.
So in terms of what is the political stance of the Komnenos family, it's marry everybody, right? And so that Alexis and Irini, they had a whole bunch of children and they continued, let's get them married into all the different factions. So it's consolidation of political power through familial relationship.
Yeah.
I think how they worked on it. And then in terms of the politics of it, they, if I were to say real innovations of Alexios, it's that he was willing to make radical changes to the way that the fiscal system of the empire functioned for the sake of reestablishing a coinage on a firm basis, establishing a military system. So he was, in terms of government action, a pretty astonishing person. And I don't think your listeners really want to get into the weeds about fiscal reform, but he was a very effective reformer. And so that enabled him to remain successful. So on the one hand, you have this familial policy of reconciliation. And I can see Nikephoros' history playing along with that, because although he makes it clear he thinks Alexios is a jerk, he does support this reconciliation of knitting all the families together.
Yeah.
Right? This is going to be a story about how our grandparents fought and why we should continue to support this unity of the
realm. Let's talk about and again, I would refer to, we made an episode about Anna a few months ago, but again, we talked a little bit about that in that episode as well. But what was the relationship like between Anna and Nikephoros? Because it seemed like he encouraged her to write history and read the history, whereas when she was living on herself, she was like 14, which was normal marriage age at the time, you know, she had to hide reading history, but it seemed like they were supportive of each other. Like they were kind of a perfect match in a sense.
I absolutely agree. And I think that's one of the things that the story about the coup, where she always hated him for not murdering his brother, brother-in-law, is detrimental.
It's ludicrous.
They must have had a very good supportive marriage, because she was able to be a writer and an author. Mm. And in her funeral oration, there are stories about how she did hide from her parents and studied in secret until they finally relented and say, okay, you can study, you know, with old men who are eunuchs, right? But when she and Nikephoros had their own household, she was able to talk with scholars extensively and have time to write. And she had, I think another thing that enabled her to write was that she had apartments in a monastery where she wasn't a monk and she wasn't part of the monastery, but she was.
Yeah, we talked about that as well. Like I always imagined that would be like a tiny cell, water dripping down, but it was like, it was like more like a comfortable living room, basically.
Yeah.
I think most people imagine like a tiny cell when they hear about it.
No. Think silk, right?
Yeah. Basically a luxury studio apartment, basically.
Right. So yes, she had her luxury loft. It was on the wall in between the men's monastery and the women's monastery. Right. And so she could look into the men's monastery. And I think that's just a way that the guys, she wanted to talk to intellectuals who are men and scholars, you know, when her husband wasn't around, I think, but I think she did that at the monastery. But also Nikephoros thought it was fine in his household to have a bunch of, you know, men who were scholars talk to his wife. So I think they got along, you know, quite well.
Didn't she stay in the same place that her mother used to stay?
Yes. Yeah, it was her mother's monastery had, her mom had imperial apartments within the monastery as well, Anna. So they were both there. We don't know how much time we spent there. We know about the monastery because we have the monastery's foundation documents, which describe its apartments, which is how we know that it's not a dark, damp cell with dripping water. It's
Kind of what you imagine you hear a monastery cell, you know.
Oh, yeah. Particularly with the old story that she was forced there after her failed. Yeah. Right, for which there's zero.
Absolutely,
no evidence at all. I think Anna and Nikephoros, they certainly disagreed on the nature of Alexius, right?
Yeah.
Nikephoros really thinks that Alexius would have made a lousy emperor and, you know, was harsh and, you know, it's a negative portrayal.
And again, we talked about this in our episode about Alexius, that he wasn't a bad emperor at all, really. He was, he seemed like a humble and kind emperor.
Oh, like I think he's a fabulous emperor in terms of helping the Roman Empire not fall. Mm. You know,
he basically saved the Roman Empire. If you look at the state of the Roman Empire at the time before his descendant, it was terrible, but after his descendants, it was basically back to normal.
It was fabulous.
So to speak.
That case is made by Anna, and I think it's strong. So I think she makes a very strong persuasive case for Alexius being a really good emperor. And so in terms of her relationship with her husband, they had that disagreement, but there isn't any other evidence that they didn't like each other. And I think humans don't have to agree on all points about everything to get along. So we think about these not as sort of stock figures from a TV melodrama, but rather as actual humans.
Yeah.
It's not hard to think that they had different views of things and still got along just fine. For an arranged marriage in an era in which you didn't have a whole lot of choice about who you spent your life. I do think that her ongoing intellectual life is a sign that he had respect for her and cared about her.
Were interested in history, both wrote history. It was a match made in heaven, so to speak.
Exactly.
Does miss that Constantine to which she was supposed to marry in the first place, though. She does write about him in the Annexial as well.
She writes about him. I think that's something that...
she had fond memories, especially of her mother-in-law there.
I think it's... I think it's rhetorically necessary for her to seem like a good person to have that moment of lamentation.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't know how much we need to take that as sincere. Right, everything in the Alexiad is rhetorically thoughtful, so she doesn't have any emotional outburst because she just can't help it.
And like we talked about before, we have to remember the time period that she writes this in, that is a totally different era than today's era that we
exactly. So, you know, and everything she puts down there, she puts for a reason, right? So it could absolutely be that she had some memory of that guy from when she was like 3. I think she's too young to have any actual memories.
Yeah.
So that it's a performative, I am going to act like a woman who properly mourned this person that she was related to. Supposed to be betrothed.
He died when he was like 7, didn't he?
Yeah. So it's, I think that's a stance that helps construct her persona as a good woman and therefore a reliable historian. And so I don't think that, you know, that's not real heart-wrenching mourning. Though she probably has some good memories of her former soon-to-be mother-in-law.
Yeah.
I'm not going to discount the whole thing.
We're going to wrap it up soon, but of course I want to end with some questions here. Like, can a Nikephoros account, and you touch upon this in your book as well, be counted as a prequel to that, Alexia? You don't agree with that, I think, if I remember, but can it be?
I think... She might have thought at the beginning that she was going to complete his history, but she actually rewrote all the stories that he tells, right? So it's a different telling of her first book, right? Of her first opening couple of chapters. It's just a different take on it. And I would say more as just a dialogue, a very refined conversation that's about history, it's about politics, and it's about our family.
Yeah.
Right? How we should remember them. And I think both were designed to be talked about, right? So you would read it after dinner, everyone would listen to it, and then you have a conversation. So that's why they're both open to some of the different interpretations, is that it's designed to be a starting point for conversation about how we should think about our family and our politics and our memories.
And you translated the Nikephoros Heroes and Romans yourself, and it's finally available in English form. So should you read that one before getting, if you haven't read the Alexiad already, should you read that one before the Alexiad?
Yeah, my translation isn't going to be published. I'm not a great translator. Okay. So I have it, but there are two that are have been completed and are in production. So soon we will have an English translation out.
Yeah,
I think absolutely I would read. I think they should be read together because they're very much, it's in a dialogue. So if you only read the Alexiad, you're getting half of the story. And there are places where it's pretty clear that she's crafting her presentation in response to the image that her husband wrote. So we get a distorted image of the Alexiad if we don't.
So you say it's kind of a prequel, more or less?
Yeah. Conversation partner.
Yeah.
You know? More like, I would say the Alexiad is a remake, right?
Yeah. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And now you have to go soon. So before you go, do you have anything you want to promote? Any social media where people can find you? If anything you want me to put in the description, and of course, where people can find your books, should they want to read them, which you absolutely should.
I think you can always just Google Leonora Neville and you'll find what I've been doing lately. I think it's a fabulously fun topic. So I would ask you just read anything on Byzantine history.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. All right. And Heroes and Romans is a, I appreciate people read that. It's a fun book.
Thank you so much for coming on this podcast.
Thank
this has been Well, we are available on social media on Instagram under Well, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. Yeah, if you are on Apple Podcasts, consider writing a little review of us on there. That would help us out a lot. I know that a lot of my listeners are listening on Apple Podcasts, so please consider taking 3 seconds to write it. It would help me tremendous. I'd love to hear your feedback. And if you have any requests for historians that you want me to have on this podcast, put it down. I'm happy to hear suggestions and topics. Please like, share, and subscribe. And I'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.